Hey guys, man, it's great to see you. Welcome to Origins. Hey, give me, hey, thank them. It's awesome. I don't know what to do in a building this nice. I'm kind of adjusting here. There's no musty smell, no need for double rubber gloves. I'm not sure what to do. But it's such a privilege to be here in Mariners. Why don't we just thank Mariners for allowing us to meet in their space? It's just gorgeous. And so we thought we'd begin the morning by just bringing a little bit of L.A. down to the OC. Thank you, Goody and Sue Ann, and a little mosaic down here. And I hope you enjoyed our guys and our team. And by the way, I have to listen. That's my daughter, Mariah, who just sang for us. Isn't that awesome? It was really fantastic. And it was some guy named Matt next to her, but that's not important. No. And we begin this morning, and we want to focus on really some of the core things that haunts most of us. You know, we spend our lives trying to do something that matters, and I'm so convinced that everyone in this room has a genuine, sincere, and true sense of how important it is to give your life to create a different world, a better world, to enhance what it means to be human, to give yourself to the human story. And I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes you do have those moments where you wonder, you know, is what I'm doing, is it making a difference in the world? Because sometimes we convince ourselves and we talk ourselves up and into this sense of fervor and enthusiasm. But there are days we wonder, you know, this is a huge, huge, momentous task and undertaking. You know, the Mississippi is a tremendous movement. It moves with power and force and energy, but it has very little effect on the Pacific. And I think one of the great challenges we have is to ask the hard questions. If everything we're doing works exactly right, because sometimes what we're trying to do is tweak, right? We come to events like this to tweak, to make adjustments, to hope that we can find a little better way of doing something. But sometimes we forget to ask the really big questions, like if we actually succeed at this, if everything we're trying to do hits its optimal effectiveness, if we move to 100% on this, will we actually bring the effective change in the world that we desire? Now, I grew up watching Star Trek. Anybody here a Trekkie fan? But by the way, man, the new one is going to be incredible with Chris Pine. It's going to rock. I can't wait. And they have Siler playing, you know, Spock. It's a nice crossover, you know, and Vulcans who eat humans. I'm not sure. It's going to be great. And me and my brother Alex, I think he's here somewhere. And Alex, you here? He's probably out there networking. And it was what you should all be doing right now. And we grew up playing Star Trek. We'd take blankets and tie them to chairs and tie them to the dining room table and create the Enterprise. And then we had two little sisters, and we, of course, wouldn't allow them on the Enterprise without Kool-Aid and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Or they would be cast out of the Enterprise, and they were lost in space, which is a different series altogether. And we never really argued about being Kirk. We always wanted to be Spock or Chekhov. I think it's because both of us being immigrants, we liked the aliens. And of course, what drew us in was that opening monologue from William Shatner, you know, way before Boston Legal and Neurosis. And it was space, right? You know the next line, right? The final frontier. Wow. And these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. And if you go back and you watch it carefully, you realize that these were not really stories about intergalactic interactions. It was the story about humanity's struggle to come together, the space between us. And you begin to realize that it was all about human relationships, about misunderstandings, about violence and conflict and love and hate and bitterness and forgiveness and community. There's this unique relationship we humans have with space. My grandmother passed away not that long ago, but I know in reality that I'm closer to her that I am to some of you right now. That my wife is in L.A. and my sister on the East Coast, but even though there's a geographic distance, we're closer than some of you are who are sitting next to each other. And some of you are sitting next to someone who's an absolute stranger, and you've done everything you can to keep them that way. You know, in a socially appropriate way, you've ignored them for the last half an hour while still seeming incredibly friendly and open to everyone. And what's amazing about us is that we can actually be touching, we can feel the warmth of another person's skin and yet be light years apart. There is massive space between us. And we humans have this capacity to live almost interdimensionally in different spaces while traveling side by side. And it was about a year ago, I'm not really sure when, I stepped into this passage of Scripture once again for the thousandth time. And I knew this passage inside and out and had taught it over and over again. But all of a sudden, it spoke to me in a way I had never seen it before. Do you have that happen? And I began to see Paul traveling in between spaces and entering into different human spaces and moving from one to the other, and each time going through a tremendously difficult struggle. It was as if he was going through a soul bends and having to recover from the different depth of human relationships he was experiencing. And I want to take you there for a few minutes and lay this out as a platform for today as we think and talk and as we process information. I'd like to suggest this as a category to begin to download the information that you receive today. It's in the book of Acts. You know the story. I'm not going to give you anything new in terms of context. But I'm hoping it will provoke some different thoughts. It says in chapter 17 of Acts, beginning in verse 16, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. And I love this because Paul can come across so philosophical and theoretical and abstract and callous and arrogant and a lot of other things. But here you get a picture inside the soul of Paul, and it says that he was motivated, he was fueled by distress that was fueled by a city that was full of idols. And I think Paul was distraught. He was distressed not only because he realized that the true and living God wasn't receiving the worship that he was worthy of, but I think Paul was distressed that he saw humanity crying out to gods who could not help them. He was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. Now, if you had this epiphany, if you walked across Athens and then you realize that the city was disconnected from the God who created them and understood them and loved them and was passionately pursuing them, had come into human history, had allowed himself to be brutalized, crucified, and had risen from the dead. If you came to this epiphany that this entire city was oblivious to this historic reality, what would you do next? Well, the next word is the word so, and so it means he's not going to act in response to this motivation, in response to this distress, in response to this concern. He was waiting for them in Athens, and he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols, so he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks. Now, you ever read the scriptures, and they really don't make any sense, but you know they're supposed to make sense, so you just pretend that they do? Right? And so you don't ever teach on that verse. You just go right past as if it was obvious to everyone. It's so clear. So that you can wax eloquent, right, on the stuff everyone already knows. But it doesn't make any sense. And Paul was distressed when he saw the city was full of idols. So he goes to the synagogue to speak to the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. This is like the Mississippi trying to change the Pacific. If you wanted to change the context, the spiritual environment, the spiritual conversation, direction of a city known as Athens, the last place in the world you would go is to the synagogue. The whole presence and reality of the synagogue was a place of escape for the Jewish people to break away and to avoid the horrific influence of the Athenians. And if you wanted to have anything to do with the Jewish context, then you were a God-fearing Greek, and you had to basically leave your Greek influence at the door and come in to be influenced by the Jewish culture and beliefs. Why in the world would Paul do that if he wanted to change Athens? I think it's the same reason why we do what we do. I think we live in this cognitive dissonance where we say one thing, but we do something absolutely disconnected, unrelated to the other. But we say this with such conviction and such confidence that it seems as if what we're doing actually is related to it, but it has nothing to do with it. In other words, like doing church and changing the course of humanity. Let's be honest, most of the time there's no relationship. Why would Paul do that? This is what I would call the first space. See, I think the reason Paul went to the synagogue to speak to the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks is because most of us are, all of us are more comfortable in our first space, in the space where we are the normative expression of what it means to be human. We love the first space where people are like us, and they think like us, and they talk like us, and they smell like us, and they move like us, and they're, just like us, and so we like them because we like us. I was watching one of the morning shows. I don't know which one it was, Good Morning America or Today or whatever it is, and they had a relational expert on. So I thought I could use some relational insight, and so I started watching. Well, this was a very specific relational expert. She was helping women know how to attract men. Not as relevant to me, but I kept watching. I'm not sure why, but I got pulled in. I thought, I need to know this. And so she started explaining, now ladies, if you want a man to be attracted to you, you need to begin to mimic his characteristics. You need to begin to observe his mannerisms and mimic his mannerisms. So if he has certain hand mannerisms, begin to mimic his hand mannerisms. And if he has certain facial expressions, begin to mimic his facial expressions. And the more he sees his own mannerisms and his own expressions expressed by you, the more he'll like you. And I'm sitting there thinking, are we this unevolved? I mean, this, guys, is this really who we are? You know what she's saying, right? See, men only love one person. They love themselves. And they spend their whole lives looking for the woman who reflects them. We're just looking for the feminine version of us. And that is incredibly unnerving and disturbing and should bother us all. And yet, having been in Los Angeles and at Mosaic for the last 17 years, I can tell you I've met so many people who are dating their twin. Happens all the time. I see people come up and I go, oh, is this your sister? And they'll go, no, it's my girlfriend. And because we're in LA, I go, so is it your sister? And I've met couples, they've married each other, but they look just like each other, and think, what a horrible thing to sleep for the rest of your life next to you and watch yourself grow older in the opposite sex. It sounds like a Stephen King novel. But the truth of the matter is that we really like ourselves, and then we like people in relationship to how much of ourselves we see in them. I mean, for years, people come to me, oh, Mosaic is so diverse. How did you guys become so diverse? Like, it's magic. See, the truth of the matter is it's really simple. We like people who are different than us. I married a small Irish girl with really, really white skin and blue eyes. I didn't want to marry anyone who looked anything like me. So my kids don't look anything like me. It's just the way it works out. But we see the similarities, the resemblance. See, the truth of the matter is that my great friends are African-American and Japanese-American and Chinese-American and sometimes just Chinese and African. And being from El Salvador, I stepped into a world where everyone was essentially different. You ever realize that the people you like, you just like because you like you? Have you ever met someone you just like right away? Just go, wow, I just really like that guy. There's just something about him. I can't really put my finger on it, but there's just something about him. We're very special, bright, you know, winsome, attractive, he's something. Gosh, I'd date him if he was a girl. I wonder how many of us, we live our lives and our faith and our ministry in this first space, pretending that it's affecting Athens, but really just living in the synagogue. doing the best we can with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. And we're all creators of first spaces, whether we realize it or not. And it just then depends on how permeable our first space is, whether our first space is a city for us or a city for others. And one of the things I love about Mosaic, and a part of our huge transition really has been creating a first space that's for us. And you can tell by the conversation that's going on. And you can still use very outward-oriented conversation, but you're about us. Where over the years, Mosaic has become a human space, not a Christian space, which is a very difficult thing to do. In fact, one of the most enjoyable moments I had was we have a gathering at a nightclub called the Mayan with thousands of pagan gods carved everywhere. And you can always tell when a church person walks in with great fear and a little bit unnerved, wondering if God's going to strike them dead. And then you can always tell when a person who's irreligious comes in because they were there last night and for other reasons. And I love that space because we get to have such incredible conversations. And one day, Sue Ann came up to me, and I was backstage hiding because I'm actually a bit of a social introvert. And so I just needed to get refreshed. And she said, "Erwin, are you coming to the 10-minute party? You see, we do a little 10-minute party after our gatherings for people who are searching for God." And we're real honest. We say, if you're here and you belong to Mosaic, you're not invited to the 10-minute party. If you're here and you're a guest from another church, you're not invited to the 10-minute party. If you're here and you're a Christian, you're not invited to the 10-minute party. The 10-minute party is only for people who are searching for God. I can't tell you how many Christians lie, deny their faith, just to come to the 10-minute party. It's very troubling. And it's really fun when people who are searching for God come and self-identify, "Yeah, I'm not a Christian," and so they can get in. And you know, we have bouncers usually waiting to stop the Christians from going in, and it's ugly. It's ugly. And so I wasn't going, and Sue Ann said, "Are you going to go to the 10-minute party?" I said, "Nah, I'm just going to take a break." She goes, "Well, we have a friend here, and would you do a 10-minute party for him?" And do you remember his name, Sue Ann? Mike? And Mike, I think, is a Chinese background, and so I said, "Oh, okay, because you can't really say no to Sue Ann," and so I didn't want to, but I was willing to, and then he didn't show up, so I thought, okay, I'm free, and I was going to go to the bathroom, and I walk into the bathroom, and Mike happens to come down the stairs, and we begin a conversation, and Mike is a Chinese genius, tech guru or something like that, atheist, and Buddhist, just atheist, all right, And so he starts grilling me with all these questions from an atheist perspective about, you know, why I believe in God and there's no God. And I mean, questions were brilliant, and I was doing the best I could. And later I gave him a disclaimer. I said, "Look, just because I can't answer your questions doesn't mean there isn't a God. It just means I'm stupid. Those are different things." And so I'm just doing the best I can, and the music begins for the second gathering, and I can tell I'm going to be on pretty soon, and we're talking. Finally, I said, "Look, Mike, I got to go." And I said, "I got to go talk." And I said, "But just before I go, just one thing." He goes, "What's that?" I said, "Look, I know you're an atheist, but I want you to know that Mosaic is for you. Mosaic is your community. You belong here." And he goes, "You mean I can be an atheist, and I can belong here at Mosaic?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "So I can go out there and everybody's going to be fine and I'm an atheist." I go, "There's a lot of atheists out there. You'll feel right at home." And just kind of going, "So I don't have to be a Christian and I can be a part of Mosaic." And the guy who brought him smiled and said, "Well, I'm not a Christian." Now, that this is exactly what I've always wanted. I wanted a first space that the person without God thought it was their space. Because you got, in fact, the guy who brought him was a Scientologist, who didn't bring him to the Church of Scientology, but brought him to Mosaic. Because it's exactly where you should bring your atheist friend from China. And I thought, this is such a beautiful thing. And in fact, later, the Benji, who is the Scientologist growing up all his life in Scientology, his parents Scientologist, a brilliantly wonderful guy, moves, I think, to Portland or somewhere like that, and he comes up to me and says, "Is there a Mosaic in Portland?" And I said, "Well, I'm not really sure." And he said, "Well, if there isn't one, I'll start it." And he's exactly the right guy to start a Mosaic, because Mosaic is a place for the guy who doesn't have a place, who doesn't yet know Jesus, but think he's really interesting, and knows that those people who belong to him create the best communities in the world. What kind of first space are you creating? A place that communicates to the world this is an exclusive space that you can only find access into once you agree with us, or it's a space that you're creating for humanity as a gift to the world because everyone needs community. Paul went to the synagogue to speak to the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks because it's what we do. We go to the first space first. But then it says, and also to the marketplace to speak to those who are there day by day. Look with me. As well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happen to be there. This is the second space. The second space is the world in which all of us live. The first space is the environments and the culture, the tribe, the movements that we create, where the outsider knows that even though they're invited and welcome, they know they're the outsider and you're the insider. And one of the great questions about the first space is it possible for those of us who are followers of Christ to create a first space for the world, not just for us? But the second space is the marketplace. It's the place where we live every day. It's where we work. It's where we play. It's where we eat. It's where we drink. It's where we live. It's where we play racquetball or golf, if you do that. And it's that place where all humanity is. And I love the questions that I get a lot of times in advance when people say, how do you mobilize the church to engage the world? You know, how do you get the church to engage the culture? And I'm going, all right, what did you do to disengage them? See, because every human you ever meet, you will ever meet, is already engaged with the world. They're already engaged with humanity. Somehow, when we connect to them and we bring them to faith, we use their new faith to extract them and disconnect them from the world they're in. And so we spend all of our energy, quote, growing our churches, getting everyone into our first space and ripping them out of their relevance in the second space, and then we spend the rest of our time going to conferences trying to figure out how to mobilize them and make them relevant in the second space. We need to actually figure out how to stop making them irrelevant in the second space, then we won't have to do the mobilization track. See, people are already there. It's the only, I got an email from the student doing a theological paper. What is Mosaic's relationship to culture? I emailed back, as opposed to like plant life. What else do you relate to? We act as if we are in a context that's disconnected from reality, but we are not. We are just irrelevant to the present reality, which is different. Worse, but different. People are open everywhere. But in the marketplace, you don't get the advantage of, quote, being right. See, we actually have been trained to only communicate from the first space. Open your Bibles, too. Well, the Bible says, well, God says, well, the Scripture says, well, you know, Jesus, dot, dot, dot. See, in the second space, people are allowed to argue. Oh, it's worse than that. In the second space, people are allowed to think. They're allowed to question. And a lot of us don't know how to relate to the second space because here's why. I mean, could you think of a more notorious strategy to make us irrelevant than to grow us up in church, in Sunday school, send us off to Bible college to major in Bible, then to go to seminary to pick up whatever we missed with our Bible degree, to take a 6-month seminary degree and stretch it out to 4 years and make it a master's degree in theology because it's so easy to study an invisible God. And then to put us right into a church based on our degree, having never had a job. And then to be the leaders of these tribes saying to them, let me tell you how to be relevant in your work. It's like putting a 5-year-old in charge of a committee on quantum physics. See, the reality is that we are not very good in the second space is because we've never learned how to thrive in it. We need to actually probably figure out how to actually work. How to thrive in the marketplace, how to actually get promoted. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? First of all, maybe we should figure out how to get hired. That would be a huge breakthrough. Or maybe we should just figure out how to have meaningful conversations with people in everyday life. That would be fun, too. I hear it all the time. No one's open. And, you know, when I fly, I love the private time of flying because I fly about 150,000 to 200,000 miles a year. It's a lot. I knew it was bad when the pilots were sending me notes. They do. Like, Mr. McManus, we're so glad you're here. Thank you for my job. And, you know, things like that. And it's like, well, I'm on these planes too much. I flew in last night from Orange County in Orlando, Florida last night. And the stewardess said, weren't you on my last flight? And I was on the red eye on the way to Orlando, spoke and turned around and came back. And so when I'm flying with the crew, there are problems. And this happened to me yesterday. I was going through security, and the security guy goes, love your church. I know that there's a problem when the people at security are saying, hi, how you doing? But I like that private time. I just want no one to talk to me. Anybody like that? I love that seat by myself. And I can't stop people from talking. I remember I was flying from Washington, D.C. to L.A., and I sat down in business class, because that's what happens when you fly a lot, and the woman next to me, the moment I sat down, said, they upgraded you, didn't they? I mean, that's so insulting. And I'm like, is that because I'm an immigrant? What's wrong with you? You know, and you know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's because I'm a Latino. You know, it's like, even with McManus, they can see. And I said, no. I mean, they probably did. But it didn't matter. It's not her business. And then she goes, see all these people? I think they were upgraded. I think she thought she was the only one who deserved to be there. Then she said, see that row over there? It's open. When the seatbelt light goes off, if it's still open, I'm going to move. And I thought, works for both of us. Win-win. And then she goes, do you live here in Washington? I said, no, I live in L.A. She goes, I hate L.A. So I just said, do you live in L.A.? And she goes, no. And she goes, I said, how about Washington? She goes, no, I live in San Francisco. And I said, oh. And she goes, yes, I just come here for the theater and the symphony because it's so nice here and in San Francisco. I just fly back and forth between the coast and the seasons. And I'm like, ah. You know, and, yes, I go back and forth between Mickey D's and Burger King, you know. love those parfaits, you know. And so it was not going well. And then she said, so what do you do? Which I hate that question. I don't know about you. Because you can't really say I'm a pastor. Because that's like saying I'm a cannibal when I have lunch. You know? So I'm always giving different inventive answers, you know. Sometimes I say I'm a futurist. And why are you laughing? I am a futurist. And I said, or I say I'm an author, a writer, which you like, and at least you're not laughing there. And then so I said, I'm a writer. She goes, so what do you write about? And I thought, you know what? I don't even want to talk to this woman. I'm just going to say God really fast because it'll end the whole conversation. And so I just said to her, oh, I wrote a book about how God meets you in life-changing moments and changes everything. You know, summary of Chasing Daylight and scary version. And then, ding, the seatbelt light went off. And I knew it was the moment. The row was open. And in one elegant, athletic swoop, I unbuckled, stood up, told her I was moving, turned. I just wanted out of there so bad. And as I was turning, she grabbed my arm. People don't have any sense of propriety and appropriateness. She grabbed my arm. And at first I thought, something's on my arm. And I looked, and it was her. And she goes, please don't go. And I said, what? And she goes, please don't go. She said, you know, I got on this plane asking myself, what's going on? I just got a call, and I found out my brother's dying of cancer. And I thought, why now? Why this moment? And I spent the next 5 hours talking to her about how God meets us in life-changing, defining moments. And don't tell me people are not open. I bought those Bose headsets so that people wouldn't talk to me. You know, the noise cancellation, you know, which code word for human eliminating. And I put those babies on. I'm flying from L.A. to Sydney, and you don't want to get in a long conversation from L.A. to Sydney. You have to be very strategic. And so I had those things on fast, and I had this elderly man next to me in his 80s, and I'm just kind of enjoying my Bose, the silence of my own little universe. I heard thump, thump, thump. The man was thumping on my boat. I thought, come on, guys, you don't thump on another man's boat. You just don't do that. And I looked at him, and I pulled off my bows, and he goes, this is a cashew. And I'm going, security? And I said, yeah, it is. And he goes, we grow these on our farm in Brazil. And I said, oh, that's nice. And a little while went back, and he thumped on my head again. And I said, yes. And he said, what do you do? I'm going to ask you, what do you do? And he said, oh, I provide all the sausages for all the McDonald's in the world. I went, oh. I can talk. I've got time. And then he asked me what I did, and I told him I write books. And he goes, what kind? And I said, you know, culture, leadership, spirituality. And he yells out, you're a God man, aren't you? Scared me. And I felt like a shaman. Or she went, blah, 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 you know, and it's like, you're a God man. I said, what? And he goes, you're a God man, aren't you? I said, yeah. And he grabs a woman in the row in front of him, shaking her. He's a God man. The whole cabin is listening to this, going, oh no, for the next 15 hours, I'm the God man. And he shakes the woman. He's a God man. He said, I knew it. I saw this light, this aura around you. Man, I hate when that happens. And that's. Got to turn that thing down, get the lights on so it's not so obvious. And he goes, I could feel it, you know. And I'm thinking of this woman, and I realized it was his wife. And I said, hey, do you want to sit with your wife? He goes, oh, no, I talk to her all the time. And we end up in this amazing conversation about who God is. And see, people are open that they just in the marketplace, in that day-by-day activity, they don't know who actually is on a journey of faith and spirituality. And you see, it isn't about information. They're not looking for people who are great at apologetics. They're not looking for great debaters. They're not looking for people with information. They're not looking for encyclopedias wrapped up in skin. They're looking for presence. And you can't fake that. And I don't know how much presence we actually have. Where Jesus is the overwhelming reality of our existence. And so I'm flying to Edmonton. And I hear this little voice in my head telling me to talk to the guy next to me, but I don't want to. So I only had my bows. I bought one of those little movie things, you know, so that it would know I'm in my space. I'm watching this. Do not interrupt. And this little voice in my head was like, talk to the guy. But he was really extroverted. It made me very nervous. And he was talking to everybody in the plane. And I didn't want to get into that. And so I said, you know, I don't know if it's God. You ever hear the voice in your head? You don't know if it's God. I mean, it's like, because God sounds like you, except when he's mad, it sounds like your wife. And then it's like, you know, I don't know if that's God. And you know, I have lots of voices in my head, and they're always talking at me and interrupting me and stuff. And so I ignored it. And then near the end, we're getting to Edmonton. I'm about to speak like to 10,000 people that night. And I thought, you know, it could be God. And I'm about to speak to all these people about God. So maybe I should do something. So I waited till the seatbelt light came on, ding. So I knew there was 15, 20 minutes max. And when the seatbelt light ding came on, I turned off my bow, turned off the movie. And soon, right away, he started talking to me. He goes, what do you do? And I said, oh, I have a company called Awaken. I pick a different thing each time. And then you know what he said to me? That's strange. I have a company called Awaken. What are the chances of that happening? And he pulls out his card. It said Awaken. I didn't even have cards. And immediately, he goes, well, what's your Awaken about? And he said, it's a technology company. He said, well, what's your Awaken about? So, well, it's a spirituality company. It's about unleashing the creative potential in every human being. He goes, cool. So how do you do that? And I said, well, you know, I believe that every person is created by this creative God. And he goes, I've had all these questions about God that I don't have anybody to talk to. And I had about 12 minutes. And I figured, well, you know, God's very powerful. He can do this really quick. And so I'm kind of moving fast forward. And all of a sudden the pilot gets on and says, we're not getting landing clearance. We need to circle Edmonton. And so I had an extra 10 minutes, and then we circled the second time, and then we circled the third time. It was either 3, 7, or 40. It was some biblical number that we circled Edmonton. And we were just talking and talking and talking, and I realized, wow, God was really saying to me, talk to this guy, but I wasn't listening. And then the pilot, but I was getting nervous now, going, I got to land, God. I got to talk to all those people for you. Because I had this little voice in my head that said to God during the flight, God, I'm going to speak to like 10,000 people for you. So you're going to have to find someone else for this guy. You never say that to God, right? Because you're a better person than me, but I say things like that. And then the pilot got on intercom and he said, we cannot get visibility to land. We have to return to the United States. And I could hear laughter. It was like God was going, come here, watch this. It's all about the timing. You know? And then it's like, ding. And then we start turning around, going back to the United States, and the guy's like, get all this time now, talk. And I could hear God say, hey, I was hoping you'd talk to him all the way here, but you were not available. So let's just go ahead and give you all the trip back and see how it goes for you. We got off the plane, had to spend the night in Seattle, and he goes, what hotel are you staying at? I'm like, oh, God, help me. And I said, I don't know. And he goes, let's stay at the same hotel. And he goes, let's stay up all night. And finally, I had to go to sleep. And he goes, I'll meet you here at 6 in the morning. And this guy was so hungry to know about who Jesus was. And I don't tell me that there's not the second space. The problem is that we are afraid of the second space. And we don't know how to earn credibility there. Because, see, in the second space, you have to live a life that earns the right to be heard. And I know, but our time is almost up. And there's this third space that's the only reason I wanted to talk to you this morning. And so we're not going to get to go there, but I'm going to at least guide you into the portal. See, in verse 19, there are four words I want you to remember. Because then Paul goes into a third space. It says, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? I love that Paul was called a babbler. I feel so much better about myself. And then others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. He wasn't like going off into eschatology or, you know, his views on homosexuality and, you know, government, politics, and God. He was just talking about Jesus. I wish that we would learn how to do that. And then it says that they took him. Then they took him. There are the four words. Then they took him. And brought him to a meeting at the Areopagus and said to him, may we know what this new teaching is you're presenting. You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we'd like to know what they mean. And all the Athenians and all the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up at the meeting of the Areopagus and said, and here's the key, people of Athens. He finally began a conversation with the Athens. And it wasn't in the first space, and it began to develop in the second space. So it was only really when he was in this third space that he began to have a face-to-face, life-changing, history-altering, future-creating conversation with Athens. See, the third space is not the space we create or the space where we all inhabit. The third space is the space you can only go when you're invited in. It is the first space of others where you are the alien, the outsider, the stranger, the foreigner. And you can't force your way in, you can't demand your way in. You can't debate your way in. You have to earn the right to be present. Then they took him. And I love it. It says, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. Don't you love this third space conversation? Instead of saying, repent, you idolaters, he goes, wow, you guys are so creative. Look how religious you are. Very different. As I walked around, I looked very carefully at your objects of worship. I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. So instead of, this is what Isaiah says, and this is what Moses says, this is what the commandment says, he says, this is what your writing says to an unknown God. And this thing that you do not know, I'm going to declare to you. And I love it. Listen to how he changes this framework. The God who made the world and everything in it, not just the God who made Adam and Eve and Israel, but the God who made the world and everything in it, is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. Not just the people of Israel, not just the people of God, not just the people who know him, not just the people who worship him, but he gives everyone life and breath and everything else. He's already your God. You just don't realize it. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. You see the shift of narrative? The narrative before in the first place would have been from one man, Adam, he made Moses, who made David. Oh, and by the way, he made Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then Israel. He made one nation, but he doesn't say that. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the lands where they should live. And so Paul is saying God chose the exact time and place that every single human being should live. And so he didn't just choose Israel, he chose every nation. He didn't just pick Abraham, he picked everyone, and he knows exactly where they are, and they're there for a reason. Let me tell you what it is. Here it is. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. Paul is saying, Athenians, God chose you to be born in Athens, to be Greek, so that you would have your best opportunity to seek him, reach out for him, and perhaps even find him. And see, God has this incredibly strategic and creative mind that he knows that there's a person who's born in Calcutta, and a person who's born in Atlanta, and a person who's born in Mumbai, and a person who's born in Manila, and a person who's born in LA, and he chooses the exact time, the exact place, whether it's in the 1500s or the 1800s or the 25th century or the 3rd century. He knows the exact time and the exact place for everyone to be born and live so they would have the optimal opportunity to turn to his son. And this is what Paul is saying. And he says, for in him we live and move and have our being. Everyone, not just people who know him, but we all are swimming in God. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And I want you to skip down to verse 34. Now, some of the people became followers of Paul. That makes us nervous, and so we don't believe that. But they became followers of Paul because, you see, in the first space, people become followers of Jesus, not you, because they already believe in Jesus. They just needed to repent of their sin and turn to God. But in the third space, they follow you first because they don't know the God that you know. And if your life leads them to God, they have a life-changing encounter with the creator of the universe. They followed Paul and believed. And among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, and a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. And here's the crazy thing, guys. See, in the first space, all we're going to see is more Marks and Thomases and Bartholomews and Marys and Marthas come to faith. And we're going to keep thinking we're changing the world, but we're just affecting the first space. In the second space, you're going to reach those people who are most like you, who are most connected to you, who are most in proximity to you. But in this third space, you start reaching Dionysius, not Thomas. And so Paul goes into a city named Athens, named after a pagan goddess of sensuality, into a mount called Mars Hill, named after a pagan god of violence and war, and quotes a poet who's giving praise to the pagan god of creation, Zeus, and then leads a man named Dionysius, named after the pagan god of drunkenness, to faith in Jesus. And by the time you are in the third space, you will lose the confidence of the first space because they will feel that you have betrayed them. And here's the problem that we have to deal with. Most of us here, we really want to be popular in the first space. Because you've chosen vocational ministry, you've almost limited your effect in the second space. But to go to the third space, to reach Dionysius and Damaris, you're going to have to be willing to give up your popularity and reward in the first space. And I don't know how many of us are willing to do that. You know, 2 years ago, I had a really bad year. It's a really hard year. I never thought about giving up on Jesus or Mosaic. But I did think about just chunking the whole Christianity thing. I was so tired, and I felt so beat up, and I saw so many websites go up telling me I was a heretic, and I was leading the world to hell. And my kids were getting bombarded with stuff. I had death threats, and I mean, it was just ridiculous. And my son was in college, and every single day he had to argue with students and professors about whether his dad was a heretic and whether I was evil. And finally, he just gave up and dropped out of school and started over again in a different place because he just couldn't take it. Well, he just didn't want to have to deal with it anymore. And every Saturday night, I would get bombarded with emails letting me know how evil I was before I had to speak on Sunday. And by the time I was going home on Sunday night, I was bombarded with more emails letting me know how evil I was. And I finally just said to Kim, I said, I just don't want to do this anymore. I really just want to just walk away from the whole thing. I just don't care anymore. I thought it'd be nice to go to Switzerland and write about learning how to ski or anything else. You know, I certainly have some trade capacity somewhere. And some of it came out of a number of things. But one of them was because a guy named John Gordon, this Jewish Buddhist energy coach, invited me on his teleseminar on energy. And I didn't say yes for a long time, but his business partner was a Christian, and he talked me into it, and he said, John, you would really hit it off. And so I went and did a talk on energy, an interview, and I don't know a lot about energy, and know a lot more now, but, you know, and so we're talking about energy. I'm doing the best I could. I was trying to be energetic and energized, and you know, and Halfway through, he asked me this question, Erwin, here's the one question my whole audience wants to know. And I thought, what's the ultimate energy question? And he said, are you Christians the only ones going to heaven and the rest of us going to hell? I thought, that's not an energy question. That's not, you know. And he threw me off, but it was live. So I had to answer fast. So I had to tell him what I really thought. And I said, well, for me to answer that, I have to explain to you a few things. He goes, all right, go ahead. And I said, I'm a person who believes Jesus is God. He goes, okay. And I said, well, you see, when Jesus walked this earth, it said of him that he did not come to condemn the world, but to bring the world life. And since he is God, and he wouldn't condemn the world, I'm not about to do what Jesus wouldn't do. So, John, I'm not going to come here to condemn you. I'm just going to come here to bring you life. He said, huh, I like that. And we went back to energy. And then 2 weeks later, and I'll close with this, and I know my time is up, but let me just, if I could, if you'd allow me this. He sent me an email. I've carried it with me to remind me why I'm doing what I'm doing. From John Gordon to Erwin McManus, subject Erwin and energy. He's consistent. And he said this, hi, Erwin, it was great having you as a guest on our teleconference a few weeks ago. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for helping me feel and understand the spirit of Jesus. You've brought him to life for me, and I'm forever grateful to you. And then he goes on to say some nice things about me. But if you have time, I have time. I'm just kidding. I'll send it to you on my Twitter. Erwin McManus. Then he says this, I grew up Jewish, followed the spiritual New Age path for a while and thought that's where I was going. I never liked organized religion, never went to church, never felt at home there. When I became an author and speaker, I wanted to speak at all the spiritual non-Christian conferences that was blocked and was blocked every step of the way. Some of you don't know there are spiritual non-Christian conferences, but I hope you know there are a lot of Christian non-spiritual conferences. Anyway, he said, my business partner, Daniel Decker, who you know, I didn't know Daniel, he just thought all Christians knew each other because we're such a small group. He goes, my business partner, Daniel Decker, who you know, started sending me scriptures and sharing websites and pastors like you with me. I would drive down the road and we'll look up at the right moment and see a sign that said, Jesus is the answer. It happened all the time. But I didn't like the church. I didn't like how they were so judgmental, unforgiving, hypocritical, etc. So I started to question all of it. I started to pray. I started listening to your podcast. When I meditated, I would see a cross. A Jewish kid from Long Island, New York, was now seeing a cross. Go figure. I connected with Ken Blanchard, who had some thoughts for me. Positive Thinking Magazine, owned by Guidepost, maybe their energy coach. You agreed to be on our teleseminar. And then he says, all signs pointed to Jesus. About 2 months ago, after a conversation with a Buddhist healer, when I read that, I thought, man, we almost had him. There's so many Buddhists out there, but I didn't even know they had healers. I mean, do they have their own shows? Do they put their hand on the screen? Do they have their own handkerchiefs? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, inquiring minds want to know. And it's like, after 2 months, after a conversation with the Buddhist healer, and then he says, not the usual way most people find Jesus. Now, I was confused. It all became clear to me, and I recently became a follower of Jesus. He said, people think that only Christians can point you in the right direction. But for me, it was the fact that God used everyone in my life to show me the way. God brought me to Daniel. He brought me to you. He brought me to the Buddhist healer. He brought me to Jesus. I wish I had been second to last, but I wasn't. The Buddhist healer taught me. And now he will bring me to those who need to hear my story. I was recently on CNN. You can watch me there. So thank you so much. I'm sending positive energy your way. John. And so I asked him, how did a Buddhist healer help you come to Jesus? Where did I go wrong? He said, you know, it was God everywhere. And you talked to me about Jesus. I went to this Buddhist healer and I said, I feel like I see Jesus everywhere. I feel like there are all these signs. I'm seeing these signs everywhere. And the Buddhist healer said, you know, John, the path to enlightenment is a difficult, difficult struggle. And even for those of us who attempt, very few attain it. He said, giving yourself to Jesus is like cheating. If you give yourself to Jesus, he instantly takes you to enlightenment. And say, so it seems that Jesus is pursuing you, so you might as well give your life to him. Oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we just learned that Jesus thrives in the third space? He's waiting for us to join him. If we could just stop playing around in the first space, stop caring what Christians say, and actually do something that makes a difference in the world. God bless.